Master percussionist Jack DeJohnette and the legendary trumpeter Lester Bowie on trumpet, of course, introducing Ntono One, my favorite tracks from DeJohnette's 1989 album, Zebra. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And today, of course, you know, is International Workers' Day. And all across America, labor and a wide range of activist groups are staging rallies and demonstrations in solidarity with a global agenda for change. For decades, the day today, International Workers' Day, which was created in memory of workers killed at Haymarket Square in Chicago on May the 4th, 1886, while on strike for 8-hour workdays, all but slipped into oblivion. But recent developments and trends in the world of work seem to have created an urgency within the labor movement to safeguard workers' hard-won turf and benefits and to check the corporate political alliance that is constantly shifting economic goalposts. I want to just spend some time today just kind of looking at the world of work.
I'm never one to be very interested in predictions, so the truth of it is, I don't know whether capitalism is at its end, and I don't think anybody else does either. And usually the ending is something we become very clear about years after it happens. So I don't know about the end of capitalism. But I will say that this is the worst condition of global capitalism in my lifetime, and I've been here a long time. And I will tell you a story. Because I went to the elite universities of the United States, I know many of the leading economists in the United States, right wing, left wing, and in the middle. And we get together sometimes for coffee or to talk. And we do not agree on how the United States got into this current situation. And we do not agree on what to do about it. But the interesting thing is, we agree on the following sentence. This is the worst condition of capitalism in our lifetimes. And I think that's a very significant comment. Well, what are the conditions that people point to? I think there are three. One is the explosive importance of the end of the Soviet Union, of the changes in the People's Republic of China, and in this following way, that it opened to Western capitalism, the capitalism of Western Europe, North America, and Japan, an immense new working class, an immense new hundreds of millions of people able and willing and eager to work as employees of capitalist companies. In a simple way, it changed the balance between the employer class, concentrated industrial power in Western Europe, North America, and Japan, on the one hand, and an increased mass of well-trained, low-paid workers. And all that we have seen, at least in the last half century, has been the working out of this radical, different situation, as the capitalists have made an enormous amount of money, basically by figuring out how to take advantage of this enormous new mass of poor but capable workers. Some capitalists did it by bringing in immigrants, low-wage, desperate immigrants to their home countries. Other capitalists did it in the reverse way, moved their production out of the old centers of capitalism into China, India, Brazil, etc. And this is a major change. And the reason it plunges capitalism into a structural crisis is that while it makes a very small number of people very, very wealthy, because basically they're substituting low-wage workers for higher-wage workers, it also presents itself as a fundamental crisis for the mass of the working class in Western Europe, North America, and Japan, because they are being told, you are going down to the level that the Third World was, because we're moving production into the hands of these Third World workers. This has not been planned. This has not been explained to the mass of workers. So they are constantly confronted by a deterioration of the social welfare system, social democracy in Europe, of the old New Deal arrangements in the United States that came out of the 1930s. And so you have a working class very much more agitated, very anxious, very worried. And I think you see that in the movement to the right politically in Germany, the support for Le Pen in France, the anger of the French working class against the Socialist Party because it hasn't helped them, the vote for Mr. Trump here in the United States, the vote for Bernie Sanders for the first time in 50 years, an American politician can take the name socialist and millions of people vote for him. All of these are signs of the failure of this system to manage the transition to extraordinary wealth for the top 5%. The second cultural structural problem is no way to handle the political impact. In other words, if you make a tiny group of people, relatively speaking, 5% or whatever the number is, very, very wealthy, and you plunge the mass of people into a declining, frightening situation, you are going to have political explosion. You have to manage that or else it will defeat you. This is the same problem as going back into the 19th century when you make the transition from agrarian feudalism into industrial capitalism. You're going to destroy many institutions. You're going to create all kinds of upheaval. And capitalism was almost overthrown, whether you look at the revolutions of 1848 or of 1870 or the Paris Commune or the revolutions after World War I. This was a mass of workers disturbed by what was going on who almost got rid of capitalism. You're now facing the other side of that problem. The rich, knowing that the mass of people are angry, have decided to manage this situation by buying the political system, by literally taking it away from any democratic foundation because too dangerous for them. But what that does is it makes the mass of people not only have economic problems getting worse, but cannot look to the political system for any kind of solution here. So they try wild things. They vote Brexit, or they vote Trump, or they vote Beppe Grillo, or whatever it is that is maybe something, even if it's strange and odd, that maybe gets them out of a dead end. Last thing, in the places to which capitalism moved, that's China, India, Brazil, there you have again the problems of 19th century European capitalism. It's a new capitalism. It's transforming this society. It is moving hundreds of millions of people off of the land into the cities and industry, and it is driving these people crazy, and they have their own tensions, and it's not clear that the people running those societies can manage it. So whether you are in the areas to which capitalism is gone and is growing, or whether you're in the areas that capitalism is abandoning, you have a level of tension between the controllers and the controlled that makes it impossible to know whether this is going to be a phase or whether it might be a system that can't handle the contradictions it has itself brought into being.
Well, he says that he doesn't have any idea, but he's not exactly telling the truth. He does have some ideas, and we're about to hear them. Here we go.
A few minutes ago, I said I wouldn't predict, and now I'm going to make a little prediction. I have not been a person who thinks capitalism is collapsing. I haven't been part of that kind of, because I don't believe in this sort of prediction business. But I will tell you that I don't see a way out. I don't see a return to capitalism concentrated in its old centers. I believe Mr. Trump, who has a desire to do that here in the United States, will not succeed in this process. He has too many enemies, which include the business community, which is not going to let him do that, I would guess. Or to put it another way, if he succeeds, the destabilization of Europe and Japan will be staggering. And it will, if he succeeds, it will be at the expense of the rest of the world. And in that way, it has parallels with German history in the 1930s and 40s also. You cannot solve these problems inside. It has effects everywhere else, and it mobilizes the whole world against you. And that's the same risk that the United States faces, and it hasn't learned anything from German history at all. Doesn't even know what that history is. So I am closer to believing than ever in my life that the system has now produced a network of problems that it cannot solve, or at least that I don't see solutions emerging that can begin to manage this level of difficulty. If, again, to use our example in America, if Trump proceeds to, for example, threaten the export economies of India, China, and Brazil, we will be in a situation which in the past in human history has gone from a trade war to a military war, and then all calculations make no difference anyway. So in that sense, I guess I am pessimistic. On the other hand, I do think there is emerging a new direction for those of us who think that the solution is not this or that law or regulation or international agreement, but that we are at a point of systemic crisis, and that therefore the only rational solution is to think about what alternative system could be established that would have a different set of problems that are more manageable than the problems of capitalism, which I don't think are manageable. And here, the left, of which I'm a part, has to be able to be not only critical of capitalism and its dead end, but also of the socialist history out of which we come. And here, I would say as simply as I can, the socialism that comes out of the 19th century and that dominated in the 20th century was in its way very successful, but insufficiently profound. That is, it was a socialism that said, the problem with capitalism is private ownership of the means of production and markets, so that what we will have is a new system with public ownership of the means of production and government planning. Public ownership and planning versus private ownership and markets. What that ignored was the organization of the workplace, where each of us goes 5 or 6 days of the week from 8 in the morning till 5 in the afternoon. That's where we spend most of our adult lives at work. If you do not transform the workplace, your efforts to transform the rest of society won't work, because they will be held back, they will be undone by the unchanged nature of the workplace. And to be simple about it, I don't think in the Soviet Union, and I don't think in the People's Republic of China, you made the transformation. What would that transformation be? Well, before I tell you, the answer, which I will give you in a minute, is the new direction, is the new system, which I think is where we're going and which can perhaps solve our problems. The answer is you have to revolutionize the workplace because it wasn't done before. Whatever you think about government ownership or state enterprises or planning has to be rethought in terms of what it would look like if it were built on the basis of a radically transformed work organization. So here's what it would look like. And here in the United States, we use the term, because it's more comfortable in people's minds, of worker co-op. And what it simply means is every workplace changes. The decisions of the workplace are now to be made democratically. One worker, one vote. And in each enterprise, in a factory, in a store, in an office, the workers collectively decide what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits. This is the democratization of the workplace. It is a radical change in how all workplaces will be organized. It gives every worker the role not only of employee, but also of employer. It destroys the foundation of capitalism, which divides people into a small number of employers and a huge number of employees. It is the end of capitalism in the same way that liberating the slave was the end of the slave economy, of liberating the serf was the end of the feudal economy. Liberating the employee, in this case, by transforming him or her into an employer at the same time, is the end of capitalism and will produce another system. And I think if we bring that to the mass of people suffering in a capitalism, they will see this as a revolution that is about them. It's not about giving some distant government all kinds of authority. It's about transforming their own lives and making the government dependent for the first time on a system of democratic control at the base so that they can have some hope of making it work in their interests rather than the interest of the employer. So for me, I would summarize by saying socialism in the 21st century will be more focused at the micro level of the enterprise than at the macro level of ownership and planning, and that's a necessary rebalancing of the micro and the macro, and therefore corrects what was the limitation of socialism in the 19th and 20th century.
You were listening to Dr. Richard Wolff, an American Marxian economist, who you listen to here, I hope, on PRN every Sunday at 2 p.m. His program is called Economic Update. Who is Dr. Wolff? He is a professor of economics, professor emeritus at the University of Massachusetts, Amherst, and currently a visiting professor in the graduate program in international affairs at the New School University in New York. He also taught economics at Yale, City University of New York, the University of Utah, University of Paris at the Sorbonne, and the Brecht Forum in New York City. In 1988, he co-founded the journal Rethinking Marxism. In 2010, he published Capitalism Hits the Fan, The Global Economic Meltdown and What to Do About It. He also released as a DVD the same book. But what is interesting, and the reason I thought about looking at the current dilemma in the world of work through a different lens, an entirely different lens, because frankly, I think we've hit the wall, to borrow part of the title of his book. We've hit the wall, and not just in the United States. We're getting indications from all over the world that the world of work itself is going through extraordinary changes, except nobody quite has a handle. I mean, when I say nobody, I mean workers don't have quite a handle on where it's going. They know something terrible is happening. They are clear that they're losing grip. They're more on the losing side than on the winning side. And yet, they don't quite know where things are going. What is the plan? What is the future of the world of work? Who will guide us to that answer? What will that answer be? What would it look like? People throughout the centuries have reported for work every day. Some, believe it or not, had a good idea because they determined what work needed to be done and they organized themselves and got it done. But we never really had an idea in recent years as to what is the value, where does the labor fit in? You make something and then what? You get paid, but what is the nature of the laborer to the labor? And then another step, what is the relationship between the laborer, and whatever entity controls both? Right now in the United States, we have two kinds of systems of work, it seems to me. We have the old kind of work where you showed up for work and you get paid, you get a salary, and you repeat. But we also have a world of work that seems to be operating outside of our normal or regular understanding of work itself. We get paid differently. We're not actually attached to a company or to any particular entity, although we are responsible for a certain amount of work. We don't control the cost of that work, nor do we yield what we think we ought to yield as a benefit of the labor that produced the work. It's a very complicated thing. The world of work has changed dramatically. There are people who are working on their own. They are their own company. But they nonetheless fit into a larger world of work in which the lines are very blurred between their authority to call the shots over their labor and the larger authority's decision as to A, whether they continue to work within that framework, and B, whether they have they continue to have full authority on the placing of value on work which would yield profits so large, but the producer of that product is not going to be participating in the profit sharing. That's kind of like what globalism does and is. So I want to ask you today, just in this environment of International Workers' Day, what is your thinking about your work? What is your thinking about the value of what you do? Do you see it? Do you see yourself changing any arrangements at all in the world of work, in the work that you do? And to what end? Do you feel that you have full value in the work that you do? Or do you think there has to be a change? And if so, what should that change be? What do you think that change ought to be? Call in at 888-874-4888. Also, you know, feel free to make a comment or to add to what Dr. Wolf has offered in terms of understanding the world of work today and in the future. 888-874-4888. Now, our foreparents, and even just our parents, their attitude and their world of work was kind of different. Their attitude was work was a way, the way that they and their families survived. It had nothing to do with whether they liked a job or not. But it was important to them that the work that they did had dignity to it. And the work that they did was a constant deposit in the future of their families, in the future and the well-being of their families. So they were prepared to go for the long haul, even at jobs that didn't treat them well, that didn't pay well, that weren't safe to do even. It was what they could get, and they took it. And they reported for work every single day. I had an experience that I wouldn't forget. Some years ago, in a place called Stonega, Virginia, it was a coal mining town. And where I went was the black end of the coal mining town. Literally, you had to cross the railroad tracks three times to get to this strip of houses. There were little cottages, little lean-tos, actually. They were not real houses. And there were about only, I'd say, 20, 25 feet from the tracks that would bring out the coal from the mines. And they came out with a rumble that shook everything. Now, when I talked with the coal miners, they really did take canaries down the mines with them. They really did. Many had black lung disease and died from it. But it was remarkable that they stuck to it. That was all that they could do. That's the only work they could get. And you had two, sometimes three generations still hanging on to that way of life. People who were retired, people who died on the job. But what was important to them was that work wasn't just about the pittance they got as a salary. Work was an affirmation of themselves and their duty to their families to continue the family line. Now, that's an interesting way of looking at work. Work is not for me now, even if I, you know, I'm at risk of all these awful things on the job. Low pay being, you know, way down on the list. People literally could die from poisonous gases in the mines. And as I said, black lung disease and all kinds of really awful things could happen to them. And they knew it and they didn't mind it. They were very, I mean, this was life. They lived literally at the end of the road. And they did so. They still live there in a cluster way down the tracks at the end of the road. And today, we have an entirely different attitude about work and the relationship with work, what it's supposed to do. And I wanted to know, what are your thoughts about that? David from River Canyon, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hello.
I just had to come outside. I'm camping in the Virgin River Canyon, which is gloriously beautiful. Way up in the northeast corner of northwest corner of Arizona. I'm listening to your program, and I think Richard Wolff has it right on the number. However, I think he's leaving out a very, very important aspect to all of us.
What do you think he's leaving out?
He needs an outside authority. By that I mean, people generally, they want to be told. They want a leader. They want leadership. They want an easy answer to complex questions. And it pretty much governs the structure of all of our thinking. I mean, it's a factor. Otherwise, I mean, I see the facts that he points out clearly. We see them the same way. And that isn't always the case. I mean, quite often, too much of the time, there's a fact and there's something entirely different, and that's the interpretation of that fact. And, of course, if you run into all kinds of problems, you know, you can listen to the politicians with your rants in Congress and in the Senate, and one guy sees a set of facts his way, and another guy sees the same set of facts another way. No communication at that level. And that occurs. What do you think?
Well, I'm interested more in what you think. He says, for example, that the future of work will require that workers themselves transform both the nature and environment of their work so that they, he called it the micro level of power as opposed to the macro
right.
level of power. Is that what you say is not going to work?
No, essentially that's the problem. Maybe I just didn't hear him correctly. The nature of the individual has to change. the way they think. And then, of course, the transformation would be to the organization of individuals with them, among themselves in their action. But it has to begin with us individually, the way we don't accept the myth of outside authority. And I don't mean that necessarily in a technological way. I don't mean it all in a technological way. Because there is an authority in, you know, in the researchers and in the part of our brains that operates so absolutely amazingly, miraculously. It's the most beautiful thing. Well, the most beautiful thing that we're part of the creative process and the way we've been able to dig deep into our science and medicine and all the rest of it. Seems like economics and self-interest is where we screwed up.
Can you think of an example that would actually, where you visualize or how you visualize this working or not working?
Well, I think visualizing is the wrong word. I think it's more awareness of what we're actually in the process of doing in our daily lives that will transform our seeing, you know, the error of our ways. And you know, so much of it we can't willfully change. That's pretty obvious. Because, I mean, given the absence of brain damage, we all want the same thing. We want happiness and love and understanding, and we just aren't getting there, are we?
But we are in a society that places a very high value, as many other countries and societies do, place a very high value on work. Work is a social obligation. But in performing that social obligation, we find that the meaning, the very meaning of what it is you're talking about, finding, if you will, a sense of satisfaction, justice, equality, and so forth. All these values basically are thrown to the wind. They're not part of the consciousness of work anymore.
Well, that's a lot to say. You've said an awful lot there. I'm kind of swimming in my thoughts right now, but I think it really comes down to, you're saying work has value. Work has value for some people in simply just earning a paycheck, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
They're not happy with their 9-to-5, and they are afraid to make a change, or they're unable to, and they're stuck with whatever. And then there are those blessed people that have the good fortune to not work until they find precisely what makes them flexible at work. In other words, the old guy passed away, of course, pretty young. Alan Watts, his thing, you know, so work should always be play. Of course, he was born into circles where he had that option. So I think that I tell young kids, young adults, they're in college now. I tell them, don't jump too quickly into your career. Examine what you really love to do. And don't let anybody tell you what that is. I mean, that's an individual matter. And if it's at all possible for you to delay a career choice until you find that special place for yourself. That would be an ideal for all of us in the world, wouldn't it?
It would. Thank you, David. How is your camping going?
Oh, it's wonderful. It's beautiful to get out of the cities and just listen to the sounds of nature and just turn the, you know, I don't have TV reception here, thank goodness.
Lucky you.
I usually get one or two bars on the phone, and I'm able to connect to the internet too, so it's always a pleasure to listen to
well,
you.
I'm so glad that you called in today and made a contribution to the topic. Thank you very, very much. And continued happy camping. 888-874-4888. It's a rare thing that we actually stop, we pause, and think about things in a more esoteric way. I mean, when we say work, everybody understands work, but they understand work in a particular way. And that is, you know, you show up, you do your job, you probably have a supervisor, and, you know, you have other co-workers, and you get a paycheck, and you just continue. You do the same thing over and over. But really, if we look at the organizational structures that we are in when we do work, are we able to transform society? Is there a chance that by the way we conduct ourselves and conduct our work, we can, in fact, influence change in our society? Take the power little by little away from the people who do rule the workplace and begin on this micro level that Richard Wolff was talking about. You begin to create a whole new dynamic that places more and more power in your hands, in our hands, and thereby we create change. We decide how we want to work. We decide what we want to do, how we want to do it. We decide what should happen, what kind of value we place on our work, and force employers to do the same. Lincoln from Mount Vernon, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you, Nutrice?
Fine, thank you. How are you doing?
I'm okay. Persevering in the midst of the aridities of life.
Well, that's the best tactic.
When I think of work, I think work probably has the meaning, or the true meaning of work has changed. But when I think of work, two things come to mind. I think of the way the human or any organism function in terms of the eye has a job, and the eye does not envy the job of the fingers. The fingers have a job, the fingers does not envy the job of the heart. The brain have a job, the feet have a job, all tendons have a job, each muscle have a job, and they all do their work. And I think that the body is kind of everything is reflective of everything, just like how, when you break down, things to its smallest, it kind of resembles the universe, the atom and the neutron and the proton, how they work in relationship to each other, and how the sun, the moon, and the earth also work in relationship to each other. So the next thing is, when I think of the animals, look at the ants. You always see them, working and doing, and you never see them looking dizzy or loafing or thinking like they're doing something they're not supposed to do. If you look at the lions, then when it's time to eat, the male lions or female lions, they all go out and they do their part. And if you look at the gorillas, and if you look at the bees, how they function. And so I think that we have lost the true definition of work. I do believe that one of the problems is economics, and economics as introduced to the world by Europeans, because economics is very similar to religion in the sense that it is not a truism, but it is taught to us as a truism. And so we have now digested a probably big lie, because economics is not, for example, it's not scientific.
You've taken us on a very high philosophical plane. I'm asking, in the way we tend to conceptualize the meaning of work, work being a service or a function you perform in exchange for pay. Whether you do this alone or whether you do it as part of an organized unit, that's generally where we are. We see very little beyond that. Could you bring us back to, in the common understanding that we have of work,
okay, I'll give
what
you a good
do you
example.
See as a practical way, can we or should we redefine this thing called work?
Yeah,
and
yeah,
how do
and,
we do
and that? Thing, in that thing that you're saying, I was actually, that thing you thought it was philosophical, it actually was very practical. But I was taking you on that journey to kind of demystify it and for us to open our eyes to see, because the more we see, the clearer we can see through the forest. Is what seems to be very complicated might be a very, very, very simple thing. You know, I, for example, I'm an actor. That's my, you know, that I have, you know, that's what I studied in college. But I have other proclivities, you know, for medicine and for politics and all like that, right? I enjoy acting. I mean, I would love to be probably garnered millions, billions from acting. But outside of acting, I do other things, like I do massage therapy. The other day, you know, I was a young fellow. He was a messenger, delivery fellow. And he stopped by this place where I was doing some corporate massage. And, you know, we allow him to get a massage. This boy, he must have been no more than about 20. And when I, even though I would rather be acting, when I do massage, I feel like it's a gift and it's like something I'm, you know, the divine want me to do. So when I touch people, I do it with an intention, you know, for mental, spiritual, and physical healing. And yes, I am also doing it for money. And, you know, I started touching this fellow and I started massaging him. And, you know, all things is going through my mind. Like, you know, I wonder if he had a loving father, this or that. What, you know? And when I was finished, he was a changed person. And he shook his hand, stuck his hand out and said, thank you, thank you, thank you. So work, it's for pay, but it's also to contribute to society. It's just like the blood delivering nutrients to all the different parts of the body, so all the different parts of the body gets its nutrition. And when we get pay is almost like the blood delivering the nutrition. And so it's a combination of things. It is simple, yet it's complicated. And there are times because of the, there's always the availability of work is most times less than the labor force. And because the labor force is bigger than the available work, we will never always be able to find the job that we necessarily love or enjoy. So to a degree, we have to kind of a compromise and mix that with, okay, we're going to contribute to society, and we might be contributing in an area where we don't necessarily enjoy, but also to, because we are supposed to be a responsible part of society, we will do something. And it's a mixture of all of those things. Hello?
Well, thank you. Yes, I'm listening. Thank you.
I wanted to make sure that... Go ahead.
You put everything in there, but it was a wonderful mix. Thank you so much for calling in and contributing that today, Lincoln. Let's go to David from Brooklyn. You're on the air.
Good afternoon, Utrice. You know, I'm a person,
David. And
I know you read my book, Playing the Game. I hit the jackpot. I had a job as an instructor teaching young people about aviation and setting them on the path for being pilots, that to me was a joy to go to work every single day. Now, I was supposed to be an instructor who was teaching you about the different parts of the airplane and the career and whatnot, but after I talked a little about that technology, I went on and talked about the skills that those people would have to be able to succeed in this field. And that, to me, was a fantastic joy every day I did it. So as I think about work, I think about thousands of years ago with the hunter and gatherer communities. I don't believe they had employers and employees. Communities worked together to do what was necessary to get ahead, and that was important. And that was important, and I think that we ought to take that consideration. What is happening now under the capitalist system with employees and employers, people are trained to be in that system to benefit those people who are the capitalists. So people are seasoned and trained from very early age to be employees, because it benefits those people who are employees. And the employer is interested in two things. One thing, really, and that's making a profit for himself. And he doesn't care if he gets it from slave labor or near slave labor, whatever it takes. And if he gets resources at the lowest price or no cost at all, that's what he does. So that's the story on capitalism and work. It has nothing to do with what is good for the masses of people in the world.
What do you see as a definitive change in the way we work, the world of work in the United States? Is it very different today to your belief than it was, let's say, a few decades ago?
Well, yes, with the so-called gig economy, the capitalists have discovered, this is going to even work better, because they can take back any benefits that people have had won in the past, in the 30s and 40s, and get people to work on these so-called gig jobs, and they don't have to worry about those things anymore. So everything is done in the interests of the capitalists who control the society. It is not a democracy. We got to get that into our heads. And they do these things for their benefit, and that's the big change. And also the exploitation of women, the new technologies like robotics and computers, and these things have made a tremendous improvement in terms of the ability for the capitalist, the employer, to extract more wealth out of the system.
Do you think that there is going to be a point where there will be a neat fit between employer and employee? What would have to happen for that?
Well, you'd have to have a situation where the employees, the workers, would be more united. But in this society, for example, the United States has those capitalists that function here, the employers, they have a tremendous advantage over, let's say, the people in Northern Europe. They have this diversity of people, and they know how to play the game to have people fighting against each other and keep their benefits high and the workers' benefits low. So it's going to be a very difficult thing to unite the people to deal with this system that we have here that benefits the rich. Yesterday I had a friend visiting me from Europe, and she commented on how the ability for social mobility in Western Europe is greater than it is in the United States. People are getting poor here, and the middle class is to some degree expanding in certain parts of Europe. So, and whereas ours is getting smaller. So the capitalists are winning. We're at war with the ruling class, and for those who don't know it, they better get wake up and find out there's a war going on against the people.
Well, thank you for that. And that brings us to the end of our program today. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Meditations and Molotovs with Vincent Emanuele. You can reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories at gmail.com. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.